from the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Mother Nature Pope.
He always comes up with lovely names for me. Today, I'm Mother Nature.
So this show is about children and parents' relationship to nature, roughly described. So I want to start out with a story. So I'm an avid backpacker. I do a lot of backpacking and used to do climbing, things like that. And this started when I was 16. I went to this outdoor school called Knowles, National Outdoor Leadership School. And it was 5 weeks. And there's like 20 of us, 16-year-olds, and then a couple of camp counselors. And for the last 5 days, they had something called survival. And what you did is you would have to walk out to a trailhead to get picked up. But it was like 5 days of walking, and they didn't let you have any food.
What? That's abuse.
So the question is, why did they do that? And here's an alternative. If you do, say, Outward Bound, they would kind of put you next to a tree with a flashlight, and you'd have to stay there for a night.
Without food?
No, you probably got food.
Okay, I'm going to that one.
Being by yourself outdoors is scary.
Yeah, you can't live without food, Dan.
Evidently, you can't. So why do you think they did that? Why do you think they had this five-day survival?
Instead of one night?
Yeah, for example.
I mean, so did the person who sent you to this place and paid for you like you? Or did they want to punish you for something that you did? Did your mom want to punish you and that's why she sent you?
Son, we have a great vacation for you.
Why would they do that? I think you would, if you can survive 5 days on your own without food in the wilderness, that is a huge, huge accomplishment. I think that would boost up your feeling of I can do anything after I survive that.
Yeah, that's what I used to think, and but then I sort of realized, you know, if you're stuck out in the wilderness and there's no food, it really doesn't matter what your mindset is,
right?
You're going to have to survive, and you will. No, it was how do you deal? You would be in teams of four or five, and it's incredibly stressful, and you're just hungry, you're hangry, and so it was really about social interaction under stress.
Whoa,
that's my conclusion.
I would fail. So, if I'm hangry, that's it. Forget it.
No, there were tough things. Like somebody's backpack fell apart and we had to go back a mile and you're exhausted.
Oh, no.
But it was kind of sweet because at night I would describe like grilled cheese.
Oh, you would torment people.
With a crisp crust and the gooey.
This is bad. Just sit there. But it didn't turn you off. It actually got you really excited.
That's sort of the amazing thing is it was a deeply miserable experience, yet I now love backpacking. And so this sort of closeness to nature became part of this, I think.
So there's some amazing places out there and organizations that work with schools that really expose kids to nature for the very first time.
Yeah.
So there's one, I just love this organization. They take kids from inner city Oakland where there's not a lot of green open spaces. And they take them, and they've probably never left a three-block radius around their home. And they take them and they show them the ocean on a California beach for the very first time.
Wow.
And it's like, you know, to watch these kids' eyes open up. They've never seen something so big, so powerful.
Right.
They get in it. They kind of help them. A lot of them don't know how to swim. And then they spend two nights at a place where they help to cultivate the garden and they eat really fresh food. And it's just an amazing, immersive experience. They have tents and bunks. They're not out like you, but these are little kids, right? These are elementary kids, and they're trying to get them to instill a love of nature and a notion that we need to protect this, that the earth is so valuable and so amazing, and you, little third grader, need to do your part and it's really exciting.
It's not to improve their scores on standardized tests?
Well, you know, interestingly, they try to find all sorts of
benefits of it.
Yes, yeah. They do. Clearly 21st century skills, you know, they're learning how to communicate and get along and collaborate and all that as they work together to make the dinner that night for their classmates.
So we're going to talk about this, but I find that strange that if I go to a beautiful concert, there's no need to justify it for some further benefit to myself or society. It's just a great experience. That's how I view the outdoors. You know, it's a great experience. I don't really need to justify it beyond that.
Well, it's a good thing that we have Nicole here then, because she can tell us that. I know that for these people, they have to justify it in order to say it's worth them missing 3 days of school and we need funding and, et cetera. But let's introduce Professor Nicole Arden. We are so excited to have her here. She holds a joint appointment with both the Stanford Graduate School of Education and the Woods Institute for the Environment here at Stanford. Her research focuses on motivation for environmental behavior. She also evaluates environmental education programs like the ones we've been talking about, after-school programs, museum programs, and she's even done a study with the Girl Scouts. So welcome, Nicole.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. So, Nicole, did you ever do Knowles or Outward Bound?
You know, I have not had the benefit myself of doing such a program, but I have worked to evaluate and do research with a lot of such programs. Huh. And, in fact, my daughter just went to a program at Walden West last week, and it was fabulous. I wish I could have stayed with them, but I didn't have the opportunity. Yeah. So I've been around a lot of programs.
I know you have.
Worked with them for 20 plus years.
I just want to know if you were ever on a 5-day survival.
I have actually been an instructor on such a program. Does that count?
Oh, really? Yes.
Yeah.
Were you eating in the tent while everybody else was suffering?
I was. Candy bars and grilled cheese.
See,
it was delicious.
That's why. This is why I don't do this. This is why. Because I know there's food somewhere. And I'm not eating the bugs.
Actually, I'm just kidding. The food is probably up in a bear bag somewhere, we were surviving too.
They were surviving. So, Nicole, you've done so much work. Do you want to walk us through one of your studies, maybe take the Girl Scout study, and just tell us about the study and some of your findings?
Sure. Well, I'll start by talking about some of our work with Girl Scouts, which is near and dear to my heart for a number of reasons. And then maybe we'll return to some of these residential outdoor education programs in a variety of settings. I love that you all started with that. We've worked with the Girl Scouts for a number of years now, specifically with Girl Scouts of Northern California, Girl Scouts NorCal. And with them, we were specifically looking at environment and conservation behaviors. And it was a really exciting opportunity to try to see ways that we could use after-school programs to encourage girls to look at energy and conservation behaviors in their home. And there were a couple of different aspects of that we were interested in as well. We were also, in addition to looking at the girls' behaviors, we were also really interested in how they might interact with their parents around that. I think any of us who've had kids know that one of the biggest challenges is the kids come home and you ask them, you know, what did you do at school today, or what did you do in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts or your after-school club? And they often say, nothing.
Yes.
I don't remember. We had chocolate chip cookies.
We remember the food.
Yes. Absolutely. Who doesn't?
Yeah.
And so one of the big things we tried to build into our program, it's called Girls Learning Environment and Energy, or GLEE, was to really build mechanisms in that would really encourage and facilitate the girls to talk with their parents. And so we had aspects called boundary objects that would encourage the girls to talk with their parents.
What's an example of a
boundary object? Example would be if we were talking with girls about taking shorter showers, we would actually have a shower timer that was part of the program. So the girls would then go home and bring the shower timer home and then have that as a way to talk with their parents about what they did at GLEE that day. Or if we were talking about turning down your thermostat or turning up the thermostat, depending on the time of year, we would actually provide them with some kind of thermostat mechanism that they would then actually, the girls, that's not a behavior that might be safe for the girls to do alone. So they would actually have to work with their parents on that. So we specifically built the program around behavioral science that the girls had to work with their parents. And we had actions that were, some of them were girl, that were individual girl behaviors they could do on their own that built their confidence and their ability to take these actions alone. And others were behaviors that they had to do with their parents.
So did the parents know that the kids were going to come home and make their house really cold? I mean, was this, did they?
That's a great question. You know, we actually tried, this is actually, it was a fun study because we worked directly with the Girl Scout leaders and the girls. So the girls had some ability to be able to choose whether they wanted to participate in this. We had 30 troops. We had 15 troops who were actually in the study and then 15 troops who were the control. And they had the opportunity to choose if they wanted to be part of the study.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're speaking with Professor Nicole Arden about a Girl Scout study that she did and how to change some behaviors around sustainability and making smart energy decisions. So did it work?
Yeah, the great news is it did actually work, and part of it is that, you know, I think a lot of times in environment and sustainability work, we go in and we look for fun activities and engaging activities, which of course is really important in a program like Girl Scouts, but we don't necessarily build it based on the best behavioral science. And so we tried to think a lot about what are things that are not only fun and engaging, but really do help the girls feel empowered to be able to take action around their own home. And so we found that the girls, both in the short term and the long term, were able to not only change their energy behaviors, but actually save money for their family in terms of the amount of energy that they were using.
That's a great outcome measure. So you ask the parents to give them your energy bills before and after this?
No. We actually did. We did work with the parents, and we did actually work with the energy companies to be able to look at energy bills.
Wow. So
that's a great study.
It is. It was a fun study, and we had actually an active control where we also were looking at some food behaviors and some transportation behaviors. Those were not as easy to move, and that might be a conversation for another day.
So an active control is, it's not like you're just leaving the control group alone. You're asking them to learn something else.
Absolutely.
So and you're trying to get the kids to come home and get their parents to eat kale.
Exactly. Maybe that was part of the problem.
Yeah. I think we've discovered why that particular one didn't work. But yeah.
So can I, this is a slight detour, but it's at the heart of this, which is a number of universities now are making tremendous initiatives in sustainability. And I think sustainability is kind of at the heart of some of the your research. What is sustainability?
That's a great question. And actually, in Stanford, among a number of other universities, are really committed to the idea of sustainability. And part of it is that sustainability is a really exciting idea that we talk a lot about environment, and we've just mentioned that word a number of times here. And sustainability is a concept that's broader than environment often. We think about it as having social aspects as well as economic aspects and environmental aspects. And it's something where we think about not only environmental concerns and social and economic concerns for today, but also for future generations. And so when we think about sustainability plans, we think about not only how can we make the world a better place and a happier place and a healthier place for us, but also for future generations. And so we think about it in terms of the built environment. Denise was mentioning, you know, kids and families who may be in an urban area. We also think about having kind of the biophysical or the outdoor environment aspects. So sustainability really is thinking about all these different aspects of our life.
And the idea is that things we do now will enable us to sustain the quality of life we have in the future. And if we don't pay attention to our electricity consumption, for example.
Absolutely. Sustain and also have thrive. I think that, you know, we often think about environment. We kind of joke in the environmental education field that we've had many generations of kind of asking, you know, saying to people that, you know, the sky is falling and it's your fault, kind of being really negative and depressing. And I like to really encourage people to think it's not only about telling people what they can't do, but also really helping people think about how can we thrive? How can we envision a brighter future? Think about things that we can do together as communities to really, and in terms of sustainability, look forward to how we want the world to be in a way that's really happy and healthy and engaging and generative for all of us in terms of economics and environment and social good.
So in the context of environment, Denise, that was sort of the goal of taking these kids to see the ocean? Was kind of stewardship?
They had a lot of different goals, but that's one of them, is to make them understand that there are these resources out there and they are for you to enjoy and help you thrive. But you also have a really important role in making sure that that continues. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're speaking with Nicole Arden today about sustainability and about being good stewards of the earth. Maybe you can even just say what that means. What does it mean to be a good steward?
I love that you asked that question, especially in light of the program that you've been describing, which is taking kids maybe from school to a multi-day or residential program. It's something in my research group, which I run the social ecology lab here at Stanford, we talk a lot about what does it mean to have kids go to a multi-day program and experience what we might say is kind of opportunities to be an earth steward or develop some kind of environmental identity. And it can be challenging. It can be kind of challenging to think about what does it mean when you're maybe outside of your everyday environment and what that looks like there, and then coming back home, it might look a little bit different. So what it can mean to be an earth steward can be taking maybe one or two actions, but often kids kind of get this idea that if they're not doing everything right, then they can't consider themselves someone who's an environmentalist or a conservationist or an earth steward. And so we actually are doing a number of studies on that right now. We're doing some what we call ethnographic studies, which means we're spending a lot of time in the field. It's a real hardship. We're hiking along with kids, and we're going to these beautiful places. It's a rough life. Thankfully, I've got some great grad students, and
that carry your food for you.
That's right. Yeah, we spend a lot of time there listening to kind of kids' language and instructors' language, and thinking about how can we be more inclusive rather than exclusive. And helping kids recognize that, none of us do everything right all the time. There's not a single person who does everything right all the time. And so it's not about making the right choices all the time. And it's also recognizing that we live in an incredibly dynamic world. Things are changing all the time. And so we need to kind of think about what makes sense in my home environment. What can I actually do? What do I have the power to do as a kid? What do I have the power to do as a parent? What do I have the power to do as, in my work life? So when you ask the question about what does it mean to be an earth steward, that can mean something different in every context. And so our studies, we're trying to think about, what does that mean in these different contexts?
Do you have tips for either educators or parents as to the best way to teach that concept? I think a lot of folks would want to know, okay, we agree we're not going to be perfect, but what are ways to get started, or what are ways to even start that conversation in school or at home?
We really encourage people to think about recognize the fact that we're all part of a community, and so that you don't feel like the burden or even the opportunity is all as an individual. And so we try to think about this idea. We were talking earlier about being whether we're psychologists or sociologists or anthropologists or kind of what kind of ists we are, what kind of studies we do, and remembering though that we're all part of a community. We're all kind of part of these layered areas of interest. So as an individual, you think about what is my individual action, but also how does my individual action connect with those of others? So getting started, you might want to think about what does it make sense to do in my particular community? What does my community need the most? Is my community one where there's a real concern around how we get our food or where we get our food? Is there a concern around the way we deal with our trash? Is it recycling, or is it composting, or is it if we're getting our food from far away, do we want to think about getting how we might get our food closer to home? Is water a real issue in my community at this time of year? Is there a concern, here in Northern California, there's been a concern about wildfire. Is that a conversation we need to have? So every community or neighborhood has different concerns at different times, and I think that offers a different angle where you as a parent, or you as a community member, or you as a kid, can find a place to get involved.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will be back with more with Professor Nicole Arden, talking about stewarding the earth and sustainability and tips for parents and educators on how to get that conversation started, next on SiriusXM Insight 121. We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Professor Nicole Arden, and we're talking about tips for parents and educators about getting kids to think more about sustainability and stewarding the earth.
So one of the interesting changes in the research that comes out of schools of education is there's been a move among many scholars to look at learning outside of school, the informal environment, in part because there's experiences you'll never get in school. In part, a lot of identity development occurs outside of school. But at the same time, schools are sort of trying to bring the outside world in. And so in California, I believe there was a large initiative so that most elementary schools have their own gardens now. And so I'm a teacher or I'm a parent, and my elementary school has got a big, big plot for a garden. What do I do to make it so the kids get the outcomes I want? that they want fresh food or that they care more about the soil and the earth? What are tips for me as a parent or a teacher to get kids engaged with this?
So there's been a huge movement over the last 10, 15, maybe even 20 years across the country, and we even see this certainly in different countries across the world, where there's been a real interest and a rise in interest in school gardens, in doing more environmental education, outdoor education, place-based education on the school grounds themselves for a number of reasons. And actually, I like the way that you phrased your question, because there are different outcomes that people can desire from that. I've done some studies here, interestingly, with some undergrads here who've been interested in that. I had an undergrad who was really interested in that movement in South Africa and looking at how different people in the school community had different ideas about what the outcomes would be, whether it's food security or whether it's science education or whether it's developing a sense of confidence, or different kids can engage in different ways in these out-of-classroom but still school-based settings. So, I think it's a great opportunity to think about how might you best engage, or maybe effectively engage in these kind of, whether it's a garden setting or some kind of outdoor classroom. So I've had the benefit of being engaged in a couple of them locally. There's some great organizations. There's Education Outside. Just here in Palo Alto, there's a number of everything from, a 3 or 4 acre garden to just a small garden plot. You can use them as ways to help kids understand the life cycle of plants throughout the school year.
My dad used to force me to work in the garden and pull weeds, and I sort of decided I don't ever want a lawn. I mean, there must be a way to do this well.
Your parents really had a thing about using outdoors to punish you. They send you on that crazy 5-day survival thing. They make you pull weeds.
Never put this together.
Dan, I think we've discovered something about you. But wait, I will say this. I have been to at least 2 schools that their entire garden is big enough and cultivated enough that they get all of their fresh vegetables from that garden.
And
for the dining room.
And that's on the assumption that the kids like vegetables. And that's why they would.
Well, actually, it makes them like it
Nicole's,
more.
Nicole's ready.
I am ready. I was going to. So there are a number of organizations that work on this. So, for example, another great organization is called Food Corps, which has worked with a lot of school districts around the country to really increase their ability to have on their own on the school's own property the ability to do this kind of whether you want to call it farm to table or school garden to table connection. And Food Corps is one comes to mind. I know the people who run it quite well, but there are a number of other organizations like that as well that try to not only have the environmental outcomes, but as you're suggesting, that kind of try to look at when kids actually grow the food, then they're more interested and engaged. Actually, a faculty member here on campus, Christopher Gardner, has done some work too, looking at some local farms and doing some research on that too.
One of his big findings was if you describe the food really well, people like it. So this is Palo Alto cabbage that's been sliced finely with a gentle Napa mustard glaze, and then people want to eat it. That was like his big.
But there
one of his
is something
findings.
The kids do get very excited. They're very proud to show you the garden, and they're proud to say, "I eat it. I like it. I never thought I did before." This is School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're speaking with Nicole Arden about the benefits of getting kids involved with the outdoors, and specifically, we're talking about school gardens now. So I have a question. I'm sure folks are thinking, how do you have a garden in the middle of, the winter in Maine? What do you do about that? Who takes care of the garden when the kids are not in school in the summer? This sounds like a really big endeavor. Are there ways to kind of scale this down and make it really doable for an individual teacher?
There are a whole variety. I mean, you can imagine, everything from a couple of window boxes. These kinds of outdoor classrooms are run in city environments, and there are things from window boxes that a couple of teachers together have worked together, or parent volunteers who are really excited and involved. I was describing the Education Outside model, which that's done in partnership with AmeriCorps, which is a really fabulous partnership that really leverages the benefits of both organizations, all the way to some that are several acres and that involve livestock. I mean, that's kind of, you know, they're, some of those are really, you know, that's a much more intensive model.
I can hear the PTA discussion. Are we buying a cow? No.
There is a school that one of the classes is goat slaughtering. I am not making that up. I have worked with a school where one of the classes is goat slaughtering.
Wow. So yeah, we don't have to go all the way to that. But you can imagine that, I mean, there are ways to make this so that's much more available to schools and to teachers and to parents and to kids who don't want to go that far. Yeah, I live in a townhouse that has a small back deck, and we grow, or granted, we're in the California climate here, but we grow herbs and oranges and limes and lemons in a pot. And it's very easy for us to be able to engage with that. And my daughter, who's now 9, but we've had these since she was 1, and she can, throughout the year, harvest them and make various, bake with them and make drinks out of them. And, you know, I think it's just a really nice way for kids at various ages to really be able to feel like they're involved in the natural world and be able to see that cycle.
Do you think that it's appropriate for educators to push is not the right word, but push is what some people might say, sort of push some of the sustainability onto their kids? Is there an issue? Some people see this as kind of political. You can get into global warming and all that. Have you ever had sort of pushback against some of this?
I have a couple of responses to that. I also, maybe we'll backtrack for just a moment to mention, with any of these school garden kind of settings, to say that many of them are used for topics in addition to environment sustainability and science. So, for example, a lot of them are used to teach literature and to teach history, to teach living history, to teach place-based education that may or may not be related to environment sustainability. So I think that there are some math concepts. There are, I think, just about every topic can be taught through those kinds of settings is one aspect of it. With regard to this idea of feeling like you're pushing an agenda, mm-hmm. I do agree that it's really important to think about who is the audience and to think about what is the topic and what's the appropriateness for that particular audience. And I think that, you know, in the field of environmental education, there has been a real effort to think about what are the guidelines and principles, and what are the outcomes that are being sought, and what are the professional standards across the field. And so, for example, the North American Association for Environmental Education, NAAEE, which is a long acronym, has worked really hard with thousands of professionals across the country and around the world to think about what are the different developmental ages and stages of kids and professional environmental educators in formal and informal settings.
Can you give one example?
Yes. So to think about something like climate change, which if you look at the scientific basis for that, and what you look at what scientists are saying around this, thinking about how is that engaged in textbooks, and how is that engaged in classrooms, and then how might teachers talk about that with their students in a way that is empowering for students, that allows students to have the skills and the civic engagement aspects to be able to engage in that conversation in a way that's appropriate for different age levels. So the way you would talk about that with kindergartners is very different than the way you might talk about that with 12th graders. And recognizing that, again, a lot of times we look at that and we kind of dump this on people's heads, but we don't actually offer options for talking about what that might mean from a political process standpoint, from a scientific standpoint, from the way you might talk about it within a community. Mm-hmm. We've actually had graduate students here at the Stanford Graduate School of Education who've done some research around this and who've looked at the way the textbooks portray some of these more controversial topics. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that the way we treat these, we need to offer people options for really engaging these topics in ways that are productive.
Great, great way to end it. Thank you so much, Nicole. There's so much to be done with the environment and what we can do in terms of education and getting kids excited about it.
So now I want to give Nicole her parting gift, which is a chia pet.
Thank you. I've always wanted a chia pet.
Thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.